This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning. We made it to another Friday. It begins today after being cancelled due to COVID and the various high-up people being sacked due to controversial comments. It's finally happening. The 2020 Tokyo Olympics begins today. Are you excited for a summer of sport? Who have you got your eye on? Well, it's a big first for Team GB this year. We are taking more female athletes than ever before. Of the 376-strong team, 201 are women. In Paris 1900, Team GB took one woman. We have come a long way since then, and it's a moment to celebrate. I'm delighted to say Nicola Adams and Dame Catherine Granger will be here to talk to us about it. And I cannot wait for the opening ceremony. Who doesn't love a big show and a massive firework display? So we're getting excited about the Olympics, and we are celebrating women in sport this morning. And I'd love to hear about the female sporting moments that stand out in your memories or mean something to you. They can be famous or your own personal achievements. I know we have a lot of talent listening. Text us 84844. The text will be charged at your standard message rate. You can contact us via social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. Or if you fancy writing us an email, go to our website. We also hear from a woman who was abused within her religious organisation this morning and has since set up a website to help people who might need support in what she calls high control groups. We'll be talking to sex worker, activist and journalist Frankie Mirren about her debut novel and nipple tattoos. Well, it is Woman's Hour. But first, at noon today, UK time, the opening ceremony of the Tokyo Olympics 2020 will begin, a year later than planned thanks to COVID. Team GB are taking more women athletes than men for the first time in 125 years. As I said, 201 are female. Women tipped to medal include US gymnast Simone Biles, Indian boxer Mary Kom, and of course our very own superstar sprinter Dina Asher-Smith. So could this be the best ever games for women? Well, joining me to discuss this, we have quite a gang. Dame Catherine Granger, Britain's joint most decorated female Olympian and now chair of UK Sport, which is the body that invests in Olympic and Paralympic sport. Double Olympic boxing champion Nicola Adams, Yorkshire's finest, had to get that in there. And Anna Kessel, women's sport editor at The Telegraph. A very good morning to all of you. Anna, let me come to you first. I understand you are unofficially calling this the Women's Games.
Yes, we've waited long enough. 125 years, we weren't allowed to partake in the first one. Very hard for inclusion over the next century and a quarter to be able to even be on the start line. And finally, not only are we more numerous in terms of numbers of women for the GB team and a near equal split globally, in terms of women and men competitors. But women are the stars of this Games. Simone Biles is very much the face of the Games globally. You've got Naomi Osaka, total rock star. The US women's football team, Megan Rapinoe, Alex Morgan. And then Dina Asher-Smith and all the wonderful stars of the women's team. So really, they are front and centre of this Games in a way that we've never, ever seen before.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Catherine, I've got to ask, you've been chair of UK Sports since 2017. Can you claim credit for all of this?
Absolutely not. No chance am I claiming credit for that one. But I think I absolutely share Anna's excitement about what we're about to see over the next couple of weeks. And the huge, you know, we should really celebrate the changes that's happened over the last century and where women are now in the games. But for Team GB, a massive change happened when we had national lottery funding came in, and suddenly the investment decisions going into sport were basically gender blind. It was all about, you know, can we give sport to cycling or swimming or sailing or gymnastics or diving, or rather than men's or women's events. And it meant that all the sports have sort of equalized and stabilized, and the drive from the International Olympic Committee to also have sort of gender equality and equity across all the sports has made a huge shift in numbers and how much we see. And to Anna's point, I think we're going to see some incredible performances, but also some really brilliant, outspoken women who talk about really important issues, as well as on their own platform from being fantastic athletes. So I think we're in for an absolute treat.
And all the young women watching who are going to be inspired, a generation inspired.
Well, this is it. I think even athletes who we speak to now have been inspired by their heroes and role models of, you know, recent years, and it's really exciting. And I think athletes often don't recognize and realize at the moment of their competition the effect and impact they have, and it's in the sort of days, months, weeks, years later you realize the impact that a performance can have on so many people's lives, and really, really positive, uplifting stuff that makes anything feel possible. And you know, right now more than any other year, we probably need that in the world right now.
Absolutely. Talking of inspiring heroes, let's bring in Nicola. In 2012, you won Great Britain's first ever female boxing gold. We're all cheering. Give us a sense of what Team G will be feeling as the games officially open today, Nicola.
Yeah, they'll be nervous. They'll be excited. There'll be a lot of feelings running through the athletes' veins. They'll be wanting to win. There'll be a lot of, I guess there'll be a lot of pressure lifted as well. They're finally there. They're finally at the opening ceremony, and they. Excuse the pun, the games are about to begin.
And obviously there's a lot of camaraderie amongst the whole of the team, but do you think the women will really be bonding? Do you think it will make a difference that there's a massive girl gang of athletes out there?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's going to be really inspiring for all the other athletes as well to see so many women performing at the Olympics. Is it the first time that... there's been more women than men.
Yeah, this is it. It's a landmark year.
Wow, awesome. Hey, that's what we like to see.
Absolutely.
More women getting involved in sport, and hopefully that'll inspire the next generation as well.
Catherine, you're Britain's most successful female rower, the only female athlete in any sport to gain medals in four consecutive Olympic Games. Absolutely incredible. But this is going to be your first Olympics since retirement from rowing that you'll be watching instead of taking part. Is that going to be strange?
I know, I'm even older than that, Anita. It's five consecutive Olympics.
Oh, sorry.
So this is like, well, no, not at all. It's more that, you know, it's been over 20 years. I've been part of it, and I've put on the kit, and I've got to march, and I've got to celebrate with the rest of the team. And like Nicola's saying, that incredible camaraderie, you do all feel together. You are part of this amazing sort of team and gang. And it's quite, yeah, it's weird. It's quite sad in a way, not being part of it again in the same way. But I get to be an excited, giddy fan like the rest of us around the country right now, and, you know, setting alarms for all times of day and night to try and catch up with the superstars of tomorrow. So it's a very different experience going to be watching it. But, I think what's brilliant is we have had the most incredible time through London 2012, Rio 2016. But every athlete I speak to, every sort of up and coming new star is thrilled to have their own ambitions and their own, they want to light up the world as well. And I think we've got just wonderful sort of passing the baton down the line of looking for new big names of tomorrow, which is just always exciting at this time of year.
And you're not only going to be watching, both you, Catherine, and Nicola are part of the BBC's commentary team this round, at this time around. Excited about that?
Yeah, I am. In fact, I'm leaving our chat now to go on to the opening ceremony, which is about to begin, because Tokyo's 8 hours ahead of us. So you've got to sort of think it's coming to their evening time now. And you know, for all of us who have been there, the opening ceremony is you know, the games begin when that cauldron is lit. And it will be very different without the tens of thousands of crowds we always get used to and get excited by. But it's still a massive symbolic moment when it all begins after a 5-year wait. So it's brilliant. It's brilliant to be joining the commentary. It's brilliant to join chatting about all these moments we're out to see. And hopefully, as you said, keep inspiring a whole new generation of folk.
Well, brilliant. Enjoy. We will be watching you, Catherine. I know you've got to go, so I will let you go. Yet Catherine is part of the BBC's opening ceremony coverage, which starts at 11:20 on BBC One this morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Nicola, let's come back to you. Now, for those of us who can only dream about it, take us back a bit. What is it like when you've trained for something your entire life to then go on and win gold?
It's an unbelievable moment. You just think back to, well, I thought back to the all the hard times, the ups and the downs while I was training, the injuries, and wondering if I'll ever be able to box again. And then you stand on top of the podium and the gold medal's put around your neck and you're like, yes, this was all for this one moment.
Incredible.
The hard work, 4 years of training, 5 years this time for the Olympians this cycle. You just put everything into that one moment. And when it all comes together, it's just like a dream come true.
And it is wonderful. It is wonderful to watch. Anna, let's talk about who some of these amazing athletes are that we should be looking out for in Tokyo. We've got cyclist Laura Kenny, taekwondo fighter Jade Jones, rower Helen Glover, equestrian star Charlotte Dujardin, all aiming to become the first British female Olympians to win gold medals at least 3 separate Summer Olympic Games. Who do you tip?
Oh, God. Well, Jade Jones has got the first opportunity in terms of chronology, and I wouldn't bet her against her with her famous head kicker shot. But don't forget Skye Brown as well, Britain's youngest ever Summer Olympian, only 13 years old, going in the skateboarding, and an amazing competitor.
She's incredible, 13 years old, and I've seen her on a skateboard. Unbelievable. Just imagine the confidence that young girl must have, or even the nerves, I don't know.
Absolutely, the nerves. I mean, if you think back this time last year, she actually was involved in a crash where she almost died. She came back this year and nailed her first competition. I mean, she is absolutely fearless, and she wants to compete in the surfing as well as skateboarding at the next Olympic Games. She's a real superstar in the making.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and again, going to inspire lots of young women. So, Nicola, who are the women boxers we should be looking out for this time?
Lauren Price. She's been winning everything recently, for the last 2 years, ranked number one. I can't see her not getting a medal at the games this time. And also Caroline Dubois, exceptional junior. She went to the Junior Olympics, got a gold there. Now she's going on to the Senior Olympics, and I expect her to get a gold as well. She's only, I think, 21 years old. But she's boxing way beyond her years. Her skill level and her intelligence in the ring is exceptional.
Do you think it's going to be quite a strange experience this year, isn't it, Nicola? That the athletes have to quarantine in hotels, no spectators. Do you think it'll affect their performance?
I think for the boxers, I don't think it will be any difference. We're used to fighting in a lot smaller crowds, a lot smaller venues. So there not being a crowd there, I don't think will do anything to the boxers' mentality of how it will affect their performances. I mean, if I was there, you've waited 5 years to get into the Olympics. There being a crowd there or not would not affect whether I'm going to win. I'm still going to be going out there to win medals, and I'm sure not just the boxers but every athlete will have the same mentality as well.
And you know, in boxing, who are the ones to watch? Who are the opponents, do you think? Who are the countries that are bringing someone who's going to be very hard to beat?
Oh, Cuba always has really, really good talent. There's a few boxers from the Netherlands as well that are very good. Russia always comes with a very strong squad, but I feel like the GB team has done really well. I watched and commentated on the qualifiers that they had, and everybody is just, they're boxing so well. I just can't wait to see them, because I know we're bringing home some gold medals. I just know, I can feel it.
Yeah, we are with you. We're all feeling the same way. And talking about commentating, so you're going to be part of the commentating team. You're commentating on female boxing and male boxing as well.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I'm always following the boxing, so I follow the men's and the women's boxing, so it'll be good to be able to commentate on that, and then also see them hopefully get those gold medals. I don't know how I'm going to be able to contain my excitement though. I'm going to be very excited.
Don't contain it. When we watch commentators get excited, it's infectious. So, you know, go for it, is what I say. Anna, some sports have started already, of course. The British women's football team beat Chile
2-0 on Wednesday with Manchester City striker Ellen White scoring both goals. So how's Team GB looking so far?
Well, really positive. You've got to put in the context as well. You know, a lot of people say, oh, why would football be at the Olympics? They've already got World Cups. But Olympic football for women, it has a completely different history. For women, it's really important. It's right up with there with the World Cup. So for the women's team to be there is very significant. And don't forget that they only got to go for the first time in 2012 and they didn't get to go to Rio. So this is only the second time that we're seeing a GB women's team. They famously didn't have any warm-up matches due to COVID issues. Versus, you know, America, who had dozens. So they are at a bit of a disadvantage. Having said that, 11 of the squad are from Manchester City. So I think they're gelling well and they know each other well enough to be able to combine and hopefully they'll do well.
And Anna, there have been some controversies to do with female athletes around the game. Helen Glover will become the first female, first British rower to compete at the Games after having children. What are some of the issues around this that have been thrown up?
Yes, I mean, it's wonderful that we've got to this point where women are equal to men in terms of numbers or thereabouts, but the Olympics is still very blind around gender equality in its more nuanced form. You know, the IOC got in a terrible flap about whether mothers could bring their babies to Tokyo. Initially, they said no, and we saw the story of Naomi Folkar, the British archer, who was breastfeeding her young baby, was told that essentially there would be no way she could bring the baby to Tokyo, and she started having to stockpile 80 bags of breast milk. Anyone who's ever expressed knows just how hard that
80
is.
80 bags.
80. She sent us a picture of her freezer. I mean, just to have to do that on top of preparing for one of arguably the most challenging ever Olympic Games, just adds an extra burden on mothers, which is so unfair. And as Catherine said, you know, what's so special about some of these women competing at Tokyo is not only are they phenomenal athletes, but they're using their platform to talk about the issues that women are facing. And Alison Felix, who's spoken repeatedly about motherhood issues, has actually set aside a childcare fund for women who were not allowed to bring their children to Tokyo and to help pay for the childcare back home, which is just unheard of and brilliant.
You're right. A lot of the women are speaking out about various issues. Let's celebrate Alison Deering, first black woman to be part of the Team GB swimming team. But an outcry when the Olympic swimming organisation said that a swimming cap designed for black hair couldn't be used at the Games.
Yeah, because in their words, it was not a natural shape of the head. And how offensive and how blind is that to the world that we live in? And ridiculous considering the success of black swimmers, particularly at Rio, you know, where we had these incredible breakthroughs. They have now been embarrassed into a bit of a U-turn several weeks on from this story breaking. But it was so frustrating that it happened in the first place. And it follows this enormous and deeply troubling trend of policing what women can and can't wear, whether it's that they can't wear hijab or modest clothing to compete, or whether that they, you know, they have to wear less clothing, in the example of the Norwegian handball team that were told they couldn't wear shorts and had to wear these tiny bikini briefs to compete and would otherwise be fined or face potential disqualification just over a pair of shorts.
Well, people can't, I mean, I'm still trying to get my head around that story. They were fined for not wearing bikini briefs. I mean,
essentially, this welcome to sport, right? This sport is a world where in gymnastics, for example, they measure the centimetres between your buttocks and your leotard. It's just unbelievable. And we have to move past this. We have to make sport a place that is welcome for all women. And we have to stop obsessing over what they wear. So long as it's safe and they can perform in it, nobody else should be judging on it.
Yeah, obsessing over what they wear and the shapes of their bodies. I'm going to bring in another couple of guests here because they illustrate what we're talking about perfectly. Artistic swimmers Kate Shortman and Izzy Thorpe are representing GB at the Tokyo Olympics. They've been very vocal about body shaming comments they've received online. Now, they've trained for 10 years and spent 40 hours a week in the pool together, mostly underwater, all working to this moment. And they join us now from Tokyo. Kate, Izzy, you're just out of the pool. How is it? How's it all going?
Yeah, we're just fresh out of the pool. But yeah, no, it's amazing. we're loving every second of it. Obviously, as you said, it's what we've been working for like over a decade together. So yeah,
really exciting. And the atmosphere here is amazing. We're just in a holding camp at the moment with a lot of other Team GB athletes, and it's just amazing, just in the environment with everyone, and the buzz is really good.
Yeah, give us a sense of that, because you're there, we're here. What's it like?
Yeah, so it's actually, so we've gone out to a holding camp, which is about a week, like training camp ahead of flying to the real venue, obviously because of the COVID restrictions. But it's amazing. There's so many different sports here that we've never really had a chance to meet before, because I think aquatics, obviously we're in an aquatic discipline, so we kind of stick together with the swimmers, divers, and water polo. But yeah, there's so many different people here.
Yeah, it's really nice to see some like new faces, or just like people that we've never like really seen or seen on social media, or like, you know, people we've looked up to for a really long time as well, and just being able to see them is amazing. And yeah,
Amazing. Now, both of you brilliantly have spoken up out recently about body shaming that you've received from trolls and bullies. What have people said to you?
I think that in the past, obviously, we've kind of got comments about shoulders being quite large, especially with swimming, obviously, naturally, because in the sport, it makes your shoulders bigger. And then also with the athletic physique, obviously getting muscles and flat chested or flat bum. And I think a lot of social trends at the moment is to be more curvy. So I think a lot of people have kind of said to us, you know, like, oh, your shoulders are too big, or you haven't got a bum, or just, you know, really silly comments that have just made us obviously feel a bit insecure about our bodies. But I think over the years we've overcome that because we've had each other and a really good environment in our sport to be able to like give us confidence in our bodies. And I think that we're just trying to get that message out across to everyone else to try and encourage everyone to have positivity around surrounding body image and not this negative thing surrounding it.
Did it impact you both? Did it really affect your confidence?
I think definitely in the past it probably did change our confidence a little bit, just because, you know, when you're training for something so hard as well, like we train 40 hours a week and we don't do it for how we look, but it's a side effect of how much you train. So when you're putting in all that dedication and time for people to just say, you know, oh, you look a certain way, it's like, it's actually really heartbreaking. But yeah, I think now we're happy and we're confident. And also I think leading back from what we said earlier, there's so many people here in the holding camp that have those muscular physiques, you know, like the athletics and different sports that all are a bit more muscular, the girls. So yeah, it's nice to see and be in that environment.
Well, I've seen photographs of the two of you, and you are outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. You're so athletic, strong, powerful. You are real life superheroes, the two of you. Aww. And you are going to inspire a generation. That's what we're talking about. And, you know, and the empowerment message young women will get from the two of you. And you've campaigned about this, haven't you? Because you took part in a photo shoot. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we took part in a photo shoot with Bluebella. So the campaign was Strong is Beautiful. So like we said, it's trying to promote the being strong, being athletic, having an athletic physique is beautiful, and it shouldn't be, you know, spoken about in such a negative way. And we're trying to, yeah, just promote it through that, I think was a really good way for us to get that message out there.
They said that like 64% of girls drop out of sport at the age of 14-15, so obviously around puberty you're getting a bit more self-conscious, and yeah, something like 80% of those said it was to do with self-esteem. And yeah, I just think for us, we had to kind of almost do something and speak out in a way that, you know, sport is such a good thing for you, you know, physically and mentally. For us, it's completely shaped our lives. Like, we are the people we are today because of sport. And yeah, I just think it's such a shame that girls should be, you know, like, it should be just made to feel like that and have to, you know, give up just because of an insecurity.
Especially when you're training for something so hard, you know, and really being attentive to your physicality. And yeah, I mean, you're brilliant role models. I'm going to bring Nicola Adams in here. You know, these girls are remarkable. They've trained their whole lives for this, Nicola. And you know what? Their mums trained as well, because both your mums were artistic swimmers who swam together. What advice would you give them?
Oh, that's, I love what you're both doing for positivity. I think it's really good. And don't just keep it up. Don't let what people are saying get to you. You're inspiring the next generation. And I think it's wonderful what you're doing. I wish you all the best of luck at the games. I know you'll do well and bring back medals. And just remember that we're all back home just watching and cheering you on. So just give it everything you've got.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, best of luck, girls. Enjoy it as well. Have an absolute ball and we will be cheering, as Nicola said. I want to thank all my guests. It starts today, 11:20, the opening ceremony on BBC One. Nicola, before you go, though, I've got to ask, because there was a Nicola Adams contingent watching Strictly in my house and we were devastated when you couldn't take part. Are you going to go back?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Never say never.
That's the right answer. Yeah, that's the right answer. I want to see you lift that trophy as well. Thank you. Thank you to Anna. Thank you to Nicola. Thank you, Catherine. And well done, Izzy and Kate. Good luck. Lots of you getting in touch as well to talk about all the bits and pieces that you remember that stand out for you when it comes to sports. This week, my daughter Zoe won Sports Personality of Year 8 at her secondary school. This recognition has boosted her confidence no end and made us all beam. Well done, Zoe. And of the 10 GB boats in Tokyo rowing, 6 are crewed by women. And someone else has said, best Olympic moment, Nicola Cook winning gold in cycle race Beijing in the pouring rain. Or was that my years? That's John. 84844 if you'd like to message us about anything you hear on the show. Now, a listener got in touch about a new group she started based on her own experiences of abuse within a religious organisation. She set up Escape Escapee, which she says will help people who want to leave what she calls high control groups. She was abused by a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses and her case went to the High Court 6 years ago. It was the first case against the Jehovah's Witnesses for child sex abuse in this country, and she won. There was written evidence in a letter that her abuser, who was dead at the time of the court case, had admitted what he'd done. He called himself a pervert. She was awarded substantial damages. She's lifelong anonymity, but when I spoke to her last week, she started off explaining what Escape Escapee intends to do.
The purpose is to support individuals who have lost their community, lost their support network, either because they've been expelled from an organisation, society, group, or they've chosen to leave that particular society, organisation, however you'd like to term it.
And what can you offer them? What would you be able to provide them with?
Initially, sort of in that moment where you're in that situation, you have lost, it feels like you've lost everything. Initially just a space to be able to talk, to know that they're not alone, to know that there's people who have been through very similar things to what they're going through now, to advise them, to signpost to the services that might be helpful to them, where in that moment, that confusion, in that turbulence, it can be quite difficult to sort of see the path forward, and just to be there as a sounding board and just like a safe, calm space where they can sort of regroup and think, okay, what happens next? Where do I go now with my life?
You have talked about this being for people who are within high controlled groups. When you say organisation, you mean places where you feel people are controlled. What do you mean? What's a high controlled group?
I think it's very difficult to define exactly what a high control group is. Certainly for people who find themselves in that situation that I'm describing, where they have lost their community, they've lost those support networks, they themselves often look back on their involvements and describe those groups themselves as actually quite high control. And I think their opinions and their voices need to be listened to. I think they're really important. For our point of view, we would have quite a broad definition of high control. It's any group, any family, any sort of organisation, any place where the group influences the members to a point that it dictates their everyday decisions or activities, or the leadership team, board, or one individual dominates and influences the members to the extent, again, that it impacts on their daily decisions and activities.
And you set this up because it's very personal to you. You've been through it. What happened to you?
So me and my sister both, we set up Escape Escapee. We both grew up as part of the Jehovah's Witness organisation. And from a very early age, we were aware that this was a very imminent possibility. Should you go against the rules of the organisation, you would be expelled and you could lose your family. We grew up from before I can remember, my father was disfellowshipped, which meant we weren't really allowed to talk to him, even though we lived in the same house. So I was very aware of that, that this was a possibility.
And then you and your sister went through something horrific, didn't you?
A ministerial servant in the Jehovah's Witnesses sexually abused myself and my sister, me from the ages of 4 to 9. And it was very much sort of he used the religion in order to do that. He went to prison in 1995 initially. So when I was 9, that's where the abuse stopped. And at that point, I didn't make any disclosures.
But you ended up taking it to court, didn't you?
We did, yeah. So in the end, eventually, so when I was older, my mother went to the police and there was going to be a criminal prosecution, but that he died before that could go ahead. But when I was 29, I took it to the High Court and I brought the first civil case of litigation against a Jehovah's Witness for historic child sexual abuse.
And the judge found in your favour, and he mentioned, I'm going to quote from his judgment here, the high level of control over all aspects of life of a Jehovah's Witness. Is he right about that? Is that description accurate when he talks about high level of control?
It was certainly my experience, and I'm very open to the fact that two individuals may be a part of the same organisation and group and have very different experiences within that group. And it's certainly not, I think it'd be very wrong to make sweeping generalisations about anything, but certainly for mine and my sister's experiences, yes, that is very right.
You talk about feeling trapped. Can you expand on that? Can you tell me how that played out?
So because you're not meant to have any association with anybody who's worldly, so anybody who's not a Jehovah's Witness, you're meant to have very, very limited interaction with. In fact, the only reason you're really meant to talk to them is in order to preach to them. It leaves you very isolated in terms of if you're facing, if you wanted to leave, so if you were to leave, you are on your own. You're facing this prospect that you're always aware of, that you could just lose everybody and lose everything, and that in of itself makes you feel quite trapped.
Because this is your community.
Yes.
And more than that, it's your faith.
Yeah, certainly for people like my mum, I was certainly not theologically inclined to believe it from quite a young age. But yeah, certainly for people like my mum, it's their whole world. It's, yeah.
And so you've set up Escape Escapee for anyone who might be feeling those feelings of there's nowhere to turn. There might be people listening who can relate.
Definitely. And even if it's a situation where it's maybe even like a temporary, if people have been expelled from any kind of group and they're just feeling that, sort of sense of feeling very lost, very confused, even if their intention to go back, this is not the purpose of this is just to create that safe space where they can have the moment to think and talk through their options. That's what this is about. It's certainly not, encouraging anybody to leave anywhere where they're happy and where they feel fulfilled.
I mean, what happened to you is so awful, you and your sister. But this was somebody in a position of power who was using that to abuse you. And were you made to feel as a child that, if you were to say anything, that it would be going against the faith?
It was more that they used the teachings of the faith. So you believe that Armageddon's going to happen, that the end of the world's coming at any point. And I was told that what I was doing, that I was committing fornication, and that because of that, I would die at this upcoming Armageddon. So certainly used the faith to put fear so I wouldn't really have the opportunity to think about disclosing or talking about it. And it's the whole thing, because as a woman in that organisation, and any kind of organisation where women aren't allowed or don't have the option or the opportunity to be any decision-making level, as I said, as a woman, especially within the organisation, you are taught that you respect to a man for advice, and certainly the elders.
Now, last year you gave evidence to the independent inquiry into child sex abuse. I mean, when you took part, how did the other victims' experiences from other situations compare to yours? And actually, how did that basically trigger you wanting to do something to help other people?
I think just seeing the similarities in terms of people finding themselves in that situation where they've either found the strength to leave or been expelled, and them seeing that, hang on a second, so many people are in such similar circumstances and they've lost everything. Me and my sister over coffee, my sister's been informally helping people for sort of years, but over coffee one morning we sat down and went, no, we can do something about this. We know what needs to happen here. Let's do this. Let's make this a formal setup where people can come to us, they can find us, that we can do some good. We can help them find that peace.
Which is remarkable, really. The fact that you and your sister decided to set this up to help other people, it's a very brave move.
You can't really sit back and do nothing when you know that people are in that situation, and you're aware of how hurt and also potentially how open they are to exploitation because they're in that chaotic moment of sort of finding their feet. Yeah, it's sort of, for us, it's very much that we just wanted to step forward and also just sort of to be able to be in a position to campaign, to question why potentially sort of safeguarding measures aren't being put in place, either in terms of child sexual abuse and protecting children, but also protecting and safeguarding for adults who are in that situation, because it is a difficult situation to be in. And I think there has to be some conversation about the duty of care that organisations have to adults and children.
What practical advice and help can you give people if they do get in touch with you?
So in terms of where to go for accommodation, training, the jobs, we're working with the Maggie Oliver Foundation. We're on their recommended referral list. They obviously signpost people. But all of these things that, you know, having that advice, having that network that you've lost, trying to be a supplementary support network in terms of advising people on the next steps forward. So this is where you go for accommodation if your family have asked you to leave the house, which often happens. You know, you can apply to us for potential for, you know, sort of small grants, but yeah, certainly signposting to various support services.
Are you worried about a backlash?
I would hope not. I would hope that everybody thinks that this is a positive thing, that nobody wants anybody to be in that situation where they've lost everything and they're quite scared. I would hope the organisations themselves or the groups, the societies would want people like us here to cushion that leaving process for people.
Now, you've been given anonymity because of the court case, but you would now prefer that to be lifted, which might come as a surprise to some people. Why? Why do you want to now reveal your identity?
I'm not sure if I really... It's not that I would want to reveal my identity. Certainly, I'd never requested the anonymity. It was sort of a technicality of the case. So it's the side that actually requested it for all the victims of Peter Stewart. However, as time's gone on and I saw the evidence that was given to the inquiry, especially from the Jehovah's Witnesses, my concerns and my fears that actually the safeguarding just isn't there, the processes aren't there within the organisation still, and there seems to be movement to implement them. And if by me relinquishing my anonymity, I can push forward on that, I can ask those questions and to push for that safeguarding to be implemented, then I would be willing to do it. But it's certainly not something I would be eager to do. It's just because I fear that it's that safeguarding, that protection isn't being put in place.
Now, in a statement to us, the Jehovah's Witnesses said they firmly adhere to the Bible, which condemns child sexual abuse as a crime, and they've provided congregants with scripturally based guidance and ongoing education on the subject of child sexual abuse. They went on to say when elders learn that someone in the congregation is accused of child sexual abuse, they immediately take steps to ensure the matter is reported to the external secular authorities as may be required by law, or if it appears that any child may be in danger, they'll also offer pastoral support to the victim and the victim's family. And they finished by saying, elders do not shield perpetrators. Do not interfere with law enforcement and leave criminal matters to the secular authorities. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard today, then please do get in touch with us. You can email us via our website. Now, sex worker, activist and writer Frankie Mirren's debut novel, The Service, is set in a fictionalised time in which the UK has criminalised the advertising of sexual services, leading to brothels being raided and sex workers suddenly finding themselves without an income. The book depicts the intersecting lives of three women, Laurie and Freya, two sex workers, and a journalist, Paula, who's campaigning against prostitution. Frankie Mirren draws on her own experience as a sex worker and an activist to explore sex and relationships, mental health, trauma, motherhood, childcare, and the compromises women have to make to reconcile their experiences with their feminism. And I'm delighted to say Frankie joins us now on Woman's Hour. First of all, Frankie, congratulations on the book. Why did you want to write it?
Oh, thank you for having me on. So I have been in and out of sex work for such a long time, 25 years since the mid-90s, and in that time I've had such a range of experiences. I feel like I've literally been in different worlds and sex work. I started working when I was 18 in Amsterdam. Looking back, I feel very protective of my younger self and that it was really quite exploitative. I felt very angry with the much older guys who felt that it was okay to buy my sexual consent. Despite that, I carried on working. I worked all over the world for several years, and then I was out of sex work for 12 years, and I went back in my late 30s. I had no idea that you could do sex work when you were that old, but it turns out that you can. And it felt so different that time around. I was part of this really supportive community, and I was working for myself, which for me was a much easier way to work. I was making a lot more money. And in that time, I'd also got involved in activism. I'm part of two sex worker collectives in the UK. The English Collective of Prostitutes and SWARM, the Sex Worker Advocacy and Resistance Movement. So I'd become really politicised, which I never was in the time before. And it felt like this really pressing issue. I mean, it's definitely one of the biggest dividing lines in feminism at the moment. And a lot of women on the left who are on side with so many issues around sex work, there will be this huge divide. So yeah, I wanted to write a book. I didn't want to write a memoir because despite so many years in therapy, I haven't really picked what was going on with me as a teenager. I haven't really picked that apart, and I just wasn't. I also don't know if I would have written a memoir, but writing fiction, you can keep everything at arm's length. It meant I could pretend things were made up even if they weren't, and there's a kind of dissociation in fiction that felt very easy for me. And it also means you get to step inside other people's minds and represent a few more characters than just yourself. That was why I wrote the book.
How did you become a sex worker? You said you were only 18 in Amsterdam. What happened?
So I mean I can remember the actual day really clearly. I was standing waiting for a tram, and this guy came up to me, and he said to me, "Oh, you look so cool. You could fit into any city." And I remember thinking, "No, I don't." I was like this chubby faced 18-year-old in trainers, and he gave me some money, and he told me, "If you want to make some more money, here's my card." And I knew immediately what that situation was. I was already in Amsterdam. I was with some friends. I'd been working as a nanny for a little bit, and now I needed a new job. I was in a pretty bad mental place, taking a lot of drugs, and we didn't really have the language to talk about mental health back then. I think the first time I really heard talk about mental health becoming the norm when I was about 31. So in all the years before that, I just thought I had a crap personality, you know, and I just couldn't handle things. So I couldn't go and do a, you know, quote unquote normal job. So this seemed like an okay solution. I mean, I feel quite horrified looking back at that time, really. And
How do you feel about it when you reflect on that period of your life?
I mean, I feel it's, you know, at the time I felt like it was kind of this life hack that I'd found a way of being able to still take loads of drugs and stay up all night and work and, you know, support myself. And I did carry, I mean, I worked in Australia and Sydney and Melbourne and in the state, in New Orleans, Fort Lauderdale, and in London. I came back and went to university in the middle of that time, and I worked in Soho. So at the time it felt like I didn't enjoy the actual encounters, but it felt like a pretty good solution. Looking back, I feel differently. I feel very, like, when I have friends now who've got daughters that age, and I just think, oh my God, I'd be disgusted if I thought of some like grandfather age man. But anyway, I went back later on and it does feel very different this time around. So I feel that there's just such,
but it's so fascinating, Frankie. Why did you go back? Because like you say, you left, you've become a journalist. Why go back?
So I was struggling as a journalist, partly because it's really difficult being a journalist. Also, I was developing a chronic illness, which I still have now. And I thought, well, I'd met all these activists and I was like, oh, actually, maybe I could go back. And I thought maybe I'll just do like a tiny bit of sex work to like top up my income so I'm not so skint. And then it started going really well. I was making just, you know, a ridiculously high hourly rate that like no one will ever pay me again in my life. And it felt very different. I felt in control. It was really very fine. You know, it's generally just quite mundane and it didn't feel awful and traumatizing like it had before. So it felt, again, like a bit of a lifesaver to still be able to make money around illness. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm really rambling. I know we don't have very long.
No, Frankie, you are not rambling. Take your time. It's actually really interesting to hear you. And then you've also found the time to write a book, a novel. And I'd love you to read an excerpt if you would. But give us some context. What are we about to hear?
Okay, so this is one of the main characters, Laurie. The brothel she works in has been busted, which happens frequently. It's illegal to share a flat with a friend, which is something many of us do for safety, illegal in the UK. Anyway, she's now done her first ever booking in a car, and she doesn't have any safety networks around that, so she's scared. I'm starting after the explicit bit because it's women's hour.
Yes, this is the PG version.
Okay. The black Audi glides off. Laurie wonders if the man will park in an underground garage in Shoreditch and take an elevator up to a bachelor pad, or if he'll pull up at a family home in Bushy and kiss his wife and go upstairs for a shower before they eat dinner and catch up on their day. She goes into a shop to buy something sweet to take the taste away. And when she gets inside, she realizes she's shaking, that for 20 minutes, she's been wondering if she might die. She pays for some M&Ms. The guy in the shop has a CCTV camera pointed at himself, and she wonders if he ever worries that today someone might kill him. I've seen your face, the man says, in the paper. That was you, wasn't it? She stands with her hand outstretched, but he holds back her change, demanding an answer. She wants to tell him that he should understand, that she knows how it must feel to have your windows broken or to worry about being robbed at work, but there's no sympathy in his face. Whores can expect no solidarity. She won't leave without her change, though, nearly £4. So she stares back at him with no expression until he shrugs and deposits the warm coins in her palm.
It's very good.
That's it.
It's very good. It's really, and you know, it's such, you really take us into a world that most of us would have no knowledge about. Is this because you wanted to represent sex workers in a way that they aren't normally represented in books?
Yeah, well, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of fiction by sex workers about sex work. There has been Paul Mendes' Rainbow Milk, which was incredible, from the UK. But in general, I feel like there are these broad tropes that sex work is represented with. So, you know, the victim chained to the radiator, or the happy hooker in a bath of champagne. And like those people exist at the extreme ends, but there's this huge, mundane, very ordinary middle where literally 70,000 of us work. And I wanted to represent that because it's just so ordinary, but also so interesting because everyone's lives are interesting.
Yeah, 70,000 of you work in the industry and everyone has an opinion on it.
Yeah, 70,000 different stories, you know, everyone has a different view and we'll never all agree. Although I will just say that every sex worker-led organisation on the planet agrees that we need full decriminalisation to make us safer. So despite, as my book hopefully points out, very often not loving this job, we desperately need labour rights and to be able to work safely.
And how has the pandemic affected sex workers?
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic was a nightmare. A lot of people's income was just immediately cut off. No way of making money. Some people carried on working because they had no choice. Like we all know that the benefit system is leaving people relying on food banks, unable to look after their kids. Swarm set up a hardship fund and were able to give out tens of thousands of pounds, which was amazing, but it was a drop in the ocean of what people needed. So, yeah, the pandemic really was a nightmare for thousands of women and people of all genders in the sex industry.
And what would you like people to take away from your book, Frankie?
I would like people to take away that there are so many views on sex work, we'll never all agree, but however we feel about our jobs, in a criminalised industry, there's no access to labour rights and we desperately deserve to work safely, even if we don't love our jobs.
Well, I'm sure it's a subject matter we'll be coming back to on Woman's Hour. Frankie, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much.
Well done. Okay. The service is out now. Now, we recently talked about tattoos on the programme and had lots of listeners get in touch. One person whose experience caught our eye was Laura Middleton Hughes, who's had 3D areolas tattooed on her breasts after reconstructive surgery. Laura joins me now, along with Vicky Martin, the tattoo artist who created Laura's nipples. Laura and Vicky, very good morning. Welcome to Woman's Hour. Laura, take me back to what happened and how you came across Vicky.
Yeah, so just quickly, I'll talk about a bit of my story. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2014, which then meant I had to go through chemotherapy and a mastectomy. I was only 25 at the time, so obviously very young to lose a breast. And I then, I started a reconstruction about a year later because I had to have radiotherapy. I chose to have implants and I actually had a double mastectomy in the end because I wanted the other breast removed for personal reasons. And so I had a double implant. They're expanders, so they're like balloons, they fill up over a period of time. So it's quite a long process. And then at the very end, you're left with silicon implants in your breasts. They are hard, they are solid, they look just like balls on your chest. But I couldn't have my nipple saved because a lot of people go through this surgery and remove every single part of the breast. I actually had nipple tattoos done in my local hospital, which are quite basic because they're obviously not massively experienced artists. And they, you know, I was happy at the time with what I had. It gave me something. And then I came across the lovely Vicky, who contacted myself actually through another, I run two pages on Instagram, a personal one and a group one with, I co-founded it with a lovely friend, Nikki, called Secondary Sisters. And I think Vicky contacted us both, but Nikki hadn't actually had any surgery for her cancer. And so I jumped at the chance. She said, would I like to come and have some tattoos done? As I say, I'd already had some done by the NHS and I didn't sort of really know what the difference would be, but I thought I'll go along and see Vicky. And just the experience was utterly incredible because what Vicky does is create not only, you know, a nipple tattoo, but it's 3D. It looks what I would only describe as absolutely realistic. She just takes so much time and care over her artwork. And that's what it is, it's artwork. And we actually filmed the whole process and actually put it out on our Instagram channel, which the response was incredible because people didn't know this service existed. They didn't realize they could have it done. And for someone who's completely flat and with no nipple, to have something that looks realistic when you're looking at it, it just completely changes the way you see your body.
Let's bring Vicky in. These 3D tattooists, this artist. What is a 3D tattoo, Vicky?
Okay, so a 3D tattoo is where we use artwork to create the illusion of actually having a nipple. Because some women can have a nipple created with surgery, but it's that one more operation, or maybe the skin's too tight. And I think women, not all women, but I think some women, just they don't want to be constantly having their nipples sticking out for a start, and they don't want to go back and have one more procedure. So by using artwork, we create the look of a 3D nipple. So it's just using our five colours. I'm obsessed with making it as realistic as physically possible.
How do you practice? Where do you practice drawing them?
Okay, so initially I practiced a lot on my leg.
On you drew like tattooed nipples on your leg?
As it stands right now, I have two that are exposed.
Yes.
Sorry. I feel it's important that if you're trying a new technique or new pigments, for me as an artist, I want to just see how it heals in my skin first. I understand that it's not the same as radiated skin, but it's the nearest closest thing I can get to check that it heals nicely. And then secondly, I manufactured these hyper-realistic breast molds, which mimic a breast as much as possible, which we use for our students.
You really are suffering for your art, aren't you? I bet it's a good talking point if you're wearing shorts.
My son doesn't enjoy a holiday with me very much. No, he does, but wear trousers, Mum.
Laura, how did these tattoos change how you saw yourself? Just, I mean, both of you, once you looked at yourself in the mirror the first time, Laura, what was that experience like in Vicky's tattoo parlour to see your breasts look like they did?
It was incredible. So the whole way along, I could kind of see what Vicky was doing because obviously I was sort of laid down. But it's until you stand up and actually visualise yourself completely sort of as you would pre having a mastectomy. I just remember looking in the mirror and just honestly thinking, wow, I've got my breasts back. I think before that, they just felt like balloons on my chest. They didn't feel like breasts. And I think every time, you know, it's one of those things that other people don't see them, but every time you're out of the shower, you've got this visual reminder that you've gone through something quite major. And then to suddenly have this, your breast, it's amazing how we do visually see things actually. And by actually having something that looks like a breast, my brain automatically kind of sees it more as a breast rather than just an implant in my chest.
And was it a nerve-wracking or painful experience to go through?
I personally don't have a lot of sensation in my breasts anyway because of obviously so much surgery on them. And I think, so I'm practically numb, although I did find I had some areas where Vicky was working on and I'd get pain completely elsewhere that was in random places because obviously the nerves, you know, might be connected to other parts. But in general, no, I found it very relaxing. It was like being at a spa. I just laid down. Vicky's so professional and has just a wonderful, you know, lovely person. And you can just chat for hours. And we were there, I can't remember, most of the day, I think. And it just felt like I was having a spa day. But yeah, it wasn't painful at all.
And Vicky, you both fought for with social media to get the images online.
Yes. Yes, I mean, you know, there's a whole army of incredible artists out there that are super trained and have the time. And, you know, social media deems our images as pornographic because the algorithm doesn't recognise it. So, you know, we've got a huge movement going on at the moment to allow our images, because if people can't see our work, then women or men will never know what's out there for them. And there's so many artists that are available to donate their work.
And you are helping so many people. Thank you both for speaking to me. Thank you to all our guests. That's it from me today. Join me tomorrow for Weekend Woman's Hour. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
What would you do if your house just disappeared?
You need to calm down. People are staring. You're causing a scene.
Too right I am. I can't find my own house.
A new five-part mystery from BBC Radio 4.
Neville, it'd be better if you didn't ask questions about that.
Nobody's seen nothing.
It was a whirlwind that took yours. It just clean sucked it up.
One man's fight for answers.
There must be a new Bermuda Triangle on Tory Island if houses can just disappear like that.
The House That Vanished. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.